Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 460th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. As well, I am an adjunct professor at the U of A. And today with us, as follow-up from our last podcast, we have Mike Culver back. And this time he's going to talk about something ever so slightly different than our colon. He's going to talk about our heart. He did this one with Adrian Lindblad, a normally who also appears on this podcast quite regularly. But Mike, tell us a little bit about the reason you chose this topic and a little bit about the clinical question.
You bet. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me back. Mike Culver, family physician, Peace River, and I love atrial fibrillation. That's my that's my claim. I took a cardiology course in residency just to understand atrial fibrillation because I didn't think we understood it very well when I was going through med school and early residency. And as you guys know, atrial fibrillation is common. And I always used to have a mantra that said, identify the cause, treat the cause, slow the rate. And we used to say convert the rate, but we don't say that anymore. And anticoagulate. And now I'd actually add in there, look, for identifying the cause, really look at booze and alcohol. And maybe, just maybe, we can make a difference. And this is stemming from a randomized control trial done in Australia. And so basically what they did is they took 140 patients with atrial fibrillation for about 6 years. Most of these, about two-thirds, were paroxysmal atrial fibrillations. Some of them were persistent. And they were regular alcohol users with a mean alcohol intake about 16 per week. They're about 60 years of age, and most of them were males. And they were actually randomized to an intervention which included oral and written advice to abstain from alcohol with monthly follow-up, positive reinforcement, or just control. They had no advice, and they just kind of went forward and see how things were going.
I was just thinking about how the ethics would go with that. You, if you're sort of enrolling them, they're probably going, let me be in the alcohol use group, please, please.
Well, very funny that you should ask that. 70% of patients initially screened. So I think they screened 700-800 people. Mm-hmm. 70% said, no way in heck I want to be in this study. So
yeah.
So that's why the numbers kind of are, you know, a bit small. And that's one of the things I think we would talk about for future is a replication larger study. Mm-hmm. So they actually looked at 6 months and they actually found that just providing oral and written advice substantially changed the alcohol intake per week from 16 to 2. And the control guys were 16 to 13, so not much of a difference. 61% of these people that were enrolled in the study actually had, in the intervention arm, had complete abstinence, just stopped drinking.
Those numbers just in and of themselves are phenomenal.
I think it's fascinating. I'd love to really see the communication pieces of what they actually
need. Yes. Yeah.
Because to me, this is an incredible intervention. And they did not provide that both in the paper and or the supplementary appendix. So I think that would be something very useful.
Mm. We do have to acknowledge that this is a select group because they knew they could have been in the group exactly. That was yeah. randomized to not drink as much. And so they had to accept that that was a possibility. So they're a little bit different than the average.
Yeah, they're more likely to do it.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
To adhere to backing off alcohol. But still, that is a huge drop from 16 per week to 2.
That's and to almost two-thirds of them to zero.
Yeah.
Again, it's a 30% of all the people approached accepted it. So again, even if this works for 3 out of 10 of people we have in our practice, I think it would be very beneficial for both atrial fibrillation and other alcohol-related conditions. So more importantly, a patient – here we've got decrease in the alcohol, but more importantly – atrial fibrillation recurrence in that 6 months was decreased from 73% in control to about 53% for a number needed to treat of 5. And I think the real kicker is atrial fibrillation-related hospital admissions went from 20% to 9, again, in 6 months. And that, to me, is, you're showing a benefit with both, you'd say, oh, recurrence, if they're paroxysmal, who really cares? But related hospital admissions, there now we really get into something which has just be admitted to hospital comes up with its own additional concern. So I think this is something that you could probably hang your hat on, 20% to 9%. There were other benefits. On average, they lost 4 kilos in weight.
That's more than the difference between a lot of the weight loss studies
exactly.
for whatever it is, fasting or low carb and ketogenic. Yep. Like, I think theirs is 0.4 or 0.6 of a kilo.
You bet, Mike.
But that's sort of it. That's the differences. That's kind of the differences for the weight loss. Like, but they're just in general, the weight losses for certainly nutritional things is around 3 to 4 kilograms. But it's exactly the same as any of these weight loss things.
So it'd be lovely to see. I mean, again, this was you talked about there was a small group of people that agreed to do the study. 140, 70% said did not want to do it. And it looked at the data and looked at the outcomes at 6 months. All of these patients were symptomatic. And so really some important things that still are left to be answered are quality of life, Beck depression inventory. And the investigators attempted to study this at about the 6 month period. And unfortunately they had about a third of people not complete those questionnaires and said, really, it's hard to say what's going on with that at that time. So I think there's some additional stuff. So I'd love to see this replicated in a larger group, longer follow-up, mm-hmm. and just see whether this change is symptom-based, whether the alcohol abstinence is persistent, or decrease and or absence is persistent, and what happens in a longer time frame. So I think this is interesting in that, we know that alcohol and atrial fibrillation are related. We know that depending on, these are cohort studies and showing the incremental increase in alcohol, and again, it's really tough because the numbers are a little bit all over the place, but the more you drink, the more likely you would develop atrial fibrillation. And so this is interesting in that on the other end of the mountain, so we always talk about, some things are associated with it, but can we actually really make a difference and or do studies show that makes a difference? And here's a great example that alcohol reduction for these patients with paroxysmal persistent atrial fibrillation will decrease both recurrence and, more importantly, hospitalizations due to atrial fibrillation. Whether it really changes their quality of life and all this down the road, I think remains to be seen. So that's the RCT data of looking at alcohol intervention and whether it changes atrial fibrillation recurrence, atrial fibrillation-related hospitalizations. And there is a whole group, for the last 40 years, of observational data of looking at, does alcohol, the increase alcohol use, does that actually increase and or associated with developing atrial fibrillation? And so some of these absolute numbers will differ based on studies, based on different populations, definitions of alcohol use, gender, male or female, separation, and some co-founders. But I think just some ballpark numbers might be helpful. So compared to non or infrequent users, defined as less than 2 drinks per month, the relative risk of atrial fibrillation appears to increase about 10% per drink per day. So if you want to look at absolute terms and absolute numbers, this is per 1,000 patient years and about over 5 years. And so if you actually looked at those patients that are drinking less than 1 drink per week, the risk of atrial fibrillation was about 15, so 15 per 1,000. If you looked at those who are drinking over 2 drinks per day for women or 3 per day for men, then the risk goes to about 21 per 1,000. So again, relative numbers are reasonable. Absolute numbers are a little bit less than we probably would have anticipated. But it sure seems like there is a persistent and consistent association. I'll just probably leave it at that.
Yeah, this is a different population. This is looking at the entire population and seeing how often you find atrial fibrillation in people who drink. Whereas the previous study was, we already have atrial fibrillation.
Yes.
And we're reducing the alcohol. But it shows, I mean, if you look at all of the criteria, I think the evidence is pretty clear that if drinking is associated with atrial fibrillation, and if you reduce drinking, depends where you are, you get less atrial fibrillation.
Yes, and less atrial fibrillated admissions.
Yeah.
Yeah, you betcha. Yeah.
And that won't be for everyone in the population, right? There'll be those who are just like in the cohort observational data, there were obviously patients who were sensitive to alcohol and got it perhaps because of the alcohol. And then there's this population that won't get it regardless of how much they drink, and then a population that would get it regardless of whether they drink or not.
Yeah, because actually, if you look at the numbers, the vast majority of people who drink don't get it.
Yeah, that's correct.
And then it's important to go back and look at the sort of the control and placebo, not placebo, but control and intervention groups from the previous study. You even if you stop drinking, about half had a recurrence.
Yep.
And if you continue drinking, only 3/4 had a recurrence. So 25%, even if they continued drinking, didn't have a recurrence. So it's just, these are just sort of the ballpark numbers that are useful for you to think about what's going on. Because I would have thought, maybe you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, if these are sort of people who have symptomatic atrial fibrillation, I mean, you wouldn't need to do 6 months of reducing your alcohol intake to see if it had an effect, would you? I think you know, if you did this for, you know, 2 to 3 months in a person who was having fairly regular recurrent atrial fibrillation, you could tell whether it was going to work in them. Wouldn't you think?
It would depend on their frequency.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Like that, James. Yeah. But it's and obviously if they weren't relatively heavy drinkers already, mm-hmm. you know, historically. And Mike, you might be different, but I kind of looked at other features of my patients who had an alcohol problem. Obviously, I might bring it up with them. People certainly with the kind of cardiomyopathy, holiday heart, you think more about it, I think. But if you could draw the association, but a lot of the time, I bet you in my career before this study came out in the Tools for Practice, I didn't draw enough of an association to advocate most of my patients to stop drinking mm-hmm. when they got AFib. I didn't think about it enough. There were some, certainly, I can think about that I have drawn the connection and made the encouragement, but this one, I didn't. I think this really sealed the deal for me of how important it potentially can be.
Yeah, and I agree with you, Mike.
Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think often our atrial fibrillators, they often come with a whole host of other conditions as well, like you said, whether it be hypertension, cardiomyopathy, diabetes, gout, all these other things. And I think you're right. I think it maybe instead of adding another med, you know, which is often what happens with these people, maybe just trying to do a non-pharmacological intervention like this may improve both the atrial fibrillation, and you could extrapolate maybe other things as well.
Yeah, because I thought
that you know these guys in your practice where we would have patients who would go on vacation or do something where they'd go on a bit of a bender and they'd get AFib. And we probably, many of us who've been in practice a while can think of that's happened with your patient. And it was pretty obvious what you needed to do with them. But the average AFibber, I don't know that I was jumping to the realization quickly as I will now, hopefully, with this new data.
You bet. We used to always say that every Albertan that goes to Shuswap Lake in BC and then comes back in August and
as they travel. As AFib.
Yeah, that's right. Like, don't go to BC.
That's the treatment of choice. Yes. The one that I remember was a guy who went to the Baja, and he acknowledged quite a few drinks, but his wife acknowledged quite a few more. That's how he got AFib.
Yeah, and here's where it's tricky, because you guys know as well as I do that the observational data for overall cardiovascular disease and alcohol use is fairly consistent. Now, I'm not talking about overall good and bad from alcohol, but certainly from cardiovascular, it's, you know, there's, depends what numbers you look at, but, you know, a 20%, 25% reduction in cardiovascular disease. But where this is very different in that we're talking about people who have a condition for which
yes.
taking it away improves that condition. So they're really apples and oranges that we're talking about.
And you're looking at, and the trouble with that data, James, as you know, is a lot of the time it's not, they don't have, you know, cardiovascular disease in people who have 8 drinks or more in a day or something like that. They're mainly focused on this kind of people who have kind of 1 to 2 a day.
Yeah, exactly.
They make that subgroup, which is probably a healthier, wealthier group, right?
Then yeah, it's all, you're exactly right. It's all very tricky. And, you know, I think when it comes to, you know, alcohol, you know, 8 drinks a day, that's too much. I mean, you know what I mean?
You heard it here first.
Yeah, I know. But it's that the nuance between, you know, 0, 1, and 2, where the data gets very tricky to interpret.
Well, that's fair.
Yeah, but
no. I would also say, I mean, it's bold to say, is that I really think that the ingestion of 1 or 2, you know, red wine or whatever, I just think you're measuring social determinants of health, and that is probably the real driver. And I really struggle with really drawing conclusions that alcohol in a low dose is actually helpful for heart disease and
or even harmful.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
either you're measuring something else. at those low rate ratios, right? Like or low relative risks. It's so hard to tell because of what Mike just said. Like I think what we're really looking at here is the healthy, wealthy effect and all those kind of things, the social determinants.
And when you have a roof over your head, some food, and a job, you know, is probably driving that, yes.
Yeah, because I've always thought that, you know, that you can define excessive alcohol, but, you know, I think it's kind of obvious.
It's who drinks more than you.
Well, no, well, that's one of them.
That was the old joke. Yes.
But it's you know, if alcohol if it is interfering with various aspects of your life, or you're drinking early in the morning, and all of those sorts of things, then those are issues, and the evidence is quite overwhelming from a health perspective that, you know, people who drink that much, you know, 6, 8, 10 drinks a day, it is terribly harmful.
Yeah, the simple way to remember about that kind of thing is if alcohol has caused a problem for you, then alcohol is a problem for you.
Yeah, keep it simple.
Yeah, for sure. No, I totally agree. So anything else that you guys want to talk about with alcohol, Mike? Or either Mike's any personal experience?
We told you about our patients, James. I think that's probably as far as it
goes. Yeah, and if people could, if this was a video podcast, you'd have seen when they said patients, they put it in air quotes, which means they're talking about themselves.
Yeah. Well, I have been to the Baja twice. So.
And Mike, yeah. I'm pretty sure you've been to the shoe
shop. Never been to the Baja. Yeah. No, but I have been to the shoe shop. You betcha. Did not come home with holiday heart, though. No, I would just say there's opportunities for interventions here, and it's not often we get a non-pharmacological intervention that makes a difference, where we talk about we think that all these things work, but actually having RCT evidence that actually does make a difference for recurrence and hospital admissions it would be great. And I can see us using, or your listeners using this for your atrial fibrillators that are admitted to hospital that have alcohol-related conditions, or even just seeing them in the office afterwards. And I think that I think the kicker, and I think I'm going to email these guys, the authors of this paper, to actually see what their written advice was that actually moved these people this much.
Yeah. And to tell you the truth, if the numbers are even close to real, this is more than you get from pharmacological treatment.
Like, yeah, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Again, these guys were alcohol users, but did not have defined alcohol use disorder.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's a couple caveats here as well.
Yeah, no, good stuff. So I'm trying to think... You just quickly mention the PIPE conference, and I'll mention one other thing after that.
Sure. So 9th Annual Practical Evidence for Informed Practice Conference, spearheaded by the PEER team, October 23 and 24, 2020, virtual webcast throughout Canada, North America. So look at the PIPE website, www.peipconference.ca, and hope to see you then.
Yeah. And I, you know, usually at the end of each podcast, you know, Mike tells you everything, you know, how great he is, but, just kidding. But we did get some kind of cool, a group of individuals from the American Family Physician looked at went over a whole bunch of family medicine, podcasts. And, we made the top five lists of the top five podcasts every family physician should listen to for medical knowledge. And I'll give everyone a plug for this. It was JAMA Clinical Reviews, Primary Care Update, Frankly Speaking About Family Medicine, which I'm not aware of that podcast, and then Peds in a Pod. And yours truly, including Mike, we were in the top five. So that was from August 2020. So it's always nice to get recognized for that. And they did a kind of quite a systematic look at how to, you know, how to think whether a podcast was any good. So that's it's always nice to get at least that sort of recognition, because, you know, for 11 years, Mike has been very mean to me.
Mm-hmm. And we lost a lot of marks for our Canadian accent.
Well, they couldn't understand any, so they just assumed it was good. Yeah, it's nice.
Canadians, you're dropping fast. You'll be out of the top five very shortly.
Yeah, no. They should have put that as one of the filters, because you get credibility right away by being just a Canadian.
I don't know if that's true everywhere.
Not sure, yeah.
So anything else, guys?
No, that's good, James.
Yeah. So I think we'll leave it at that. Thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.
So long for now.